from deep inside your radio.
All right. That's the way to start off on a Mardi Gras weekend. Ladies and gentlemen, from the French Quarter of New Orleans, Louisiana. If this show is broadcast intact, I will be the most surprised person in the world because we are operating from behind. You know, I every week point out the degree to which the United States, or at least its citizens, are existing now inside a bubble, inside a media bubble, where a lot of news doesn't penetrate. Well, today I'd tell you, I'm talking from inside the beaded bubble, and we don't. It's of course we're celebrating the Iraqi election. You know, that's what the crowds are here celebrating, no doubt about it. If you were to ask, I haven't actually asked, but I'm sure that's what they're celebrating. That's why they're throwing the beads, is the joy at the Iraqi election and the parades and the costumes and stuff. It was pointed out on this broadcast a couple of weeks ago that the administration in the run-up to the Iraqi election was being assiduous in demanding that no numerical standards be applied to the results of the Iraqi election. But we don't, said the administration spokesman at the time, want this to be a numbers game. So it is, of course, that now that some Iraqis actually did turn out to vote, the numbers are being bruited about as being highly significant, even though there's up to now, as is pointed out by editor and publisher magazine, absolutely, well, not absolutely, relatively no basis for those numbers. The 60% figure, the 8 million figure, they were given to, I know this is hard to imagine, a credulous press by an administration trying to put the best face on the elections, because there is no standard for success, and it's not a numbers game. So how about 8 million? You like that numbers game? Dateline Baghdad, because even through the beaded curtain, I can, even through the beaded bubble, I can see this. Dateline Baghdad, partial results from the election suggest that U.S.-backed Prime Minister Ayad Alawi's coalition is being roundly defeated by a list with the backing of Iraq's senior Shiite cleric, I said Shiite, diminishing Alawi's chances of retaining his post. Sharif Ali bin Hussein, head of the Constitutional Monarchy Party, hey, that's got a nice ring to it, likened the vote outcome to a Sistami tsunami. I like the sound of that. That guy's got a way with words. That would shake the nation. Quote, Americans are in for a shock, he said, adding that one day they would realize we've got 150,000 troops here protecting a country that's extremely friendly to Iran and training their troops, unquote. That's something to feel. That's a feel-good kind of quote, isn't it? Safwai Rashid, he's a member of the Election Commission in Iraq, warned observers not to read too much into the early numbers. This is not a numbers game. And my favorite story so far from way outside the bubble, I think it's a French news service. I hesitate even to repeat it on the air because I haven't had the time, ladies and gentlemen, with all the celebrating of the Iraqi election here, to Google this up and see how far this story can, how the degree of leghood this story has. But there is a story on a wire service somewhere in the world, I think it's France, alleging, Have I hedged it about enough now? That a lot of Iraqis voted for the best of reasons, because if they didn't, they'd lose their food rations. But we'll see if that turns out to be true. I'm not sure about that. Dateline Washington, in what may be a formal acknowledgement of the obvious, the CIA has issued a classified report revising its pre-war assessments on Iraq and concluding that Baghdad abandoned its chemical weapons programs in 1991. There, I'm glad we got that straightened out. Hello, welcome to the show.
Coming from all around.
Chicken up high, Mardi Gras. Chicken up high. who's a team, babe. By up ahead in a whoop by way. Crazy wild man, shotgun in his hand. In a wild whoop by, he gon' take his thing.
Check it up, Mighty Crown. Check it up, Mighty Crown. Back away, engines come and get the hell out of the way. Ain't nobody gotta look no further. Get your whole gang, your sister, your brother.
Check it up, Mighty Crown. Check it up, Mighty Crown. Check it up, Mighty Crown. Check it up, Mighty Crown.
See what I think. What I say.
From the French Quarter in New Orleans, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to another edition of Le Show. In case you can't understand what the words were of that, they were basically saying we celebrate the triumph of our Iraqi brethren and sistren in this time. So, ladies and gentlemen, I am in receipt. I know you know that at the beginning of his trial, Michael Jackson issued a videotaped statement, which I think was all over the internet and may have been all over your TV screens as well. What's not as widely known is that there was a he shot an earlier draft of the statement, which I've been able to gain access to here.
Information has been released into the media about me. Apparently, this information was leaked through transcripts in a grand jury proceeding, where neither my malicious lawyers nor I ever appeared. The information is disgusting, true, and false. Years ago, I allowed a family to visit and spend some time in Neverland. Neverland is my home. Neverland is disgusting, a nightmare for my family. I allowed this family into my home because they told me their son was vulnerable and needed my help. Through the years, I have apparently helped thousands of children who were ill or vulnerable. These events have caused stress for my children and me. I never intend to place myself in so malicious a position ever again. I love my community. These events have caused a nightmare for my community. Please keep my community open. I have great faith in our system. And let me have my children. I deserve justice. I will quit it. Thank you.
Well, you'll quit it. That's the good news. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
A lot of people sorry this week. The Washington Times has apologized for running an anti-Semitic advertisement last month. The newspaper has not yet printed the apology in its pages, where most people who care about the Washington Times, I guess, would read it. In a letter to the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Washington, Times Vice President and General Manager Richard Amberg Jr. said he was sorry both personally on behalf of the Washington Times for the offensive ad that appeared on January 20th. The advertisement was headlined, "President Bush, may the Lord Jesus Christ bless you and guide you in your second term," but continued, Quote, however, do not continue to allow those folk of the Antichrist to influence you and or control you. Washington Times, owned by the Unification Church, ladies and gentlemen. Your listening pleasure. Dateline Hollywood, U2 has issued an open letter to its fan club members in hopes of dismantling their frustration of being shut out of prime tickets to the group's upcoming tour, access that had been promised as part of club membership. Many people who joined U2.com and didn't get tickets are understandably angry, states the apologetic letter from drummer Larry Mullen. The note tells the fans they'll be at the front of the line for the tickets for the next leg of the tour. The idea that longtime fans and scalpers competed for U2 tickets through our own website is appalling to me, the drummer wrote. I want to apologize to you who have suffered that. An apology from a drummer, ladies and gentlemen. Truly, we're living in wondrous times. Dateline Orlando, Florida. The Diocese of Orlando has issued a public apology to the family of a girl hazed by her soccer team. The girl's family alleges she suffered a brain injury at the hands of her teammates while on a high school soccer trip. The diocese made the apology Thursday morning. A message currently in circulation on jihadist message boards has an Iraqi by the nickname of Al-Iraqi 4 admitting to being behind the hoax of a U.S. soldier's alleged capture by the Mujahideen. He used a toy soldier that he named John Adam. Here's the text. Soldier John Adam is only a toy. I'm a 20-year-old Iraqi young man. I am unarmed, independent, and do not belong to any party or group. I apologize to all the parties and everyone, for I meant nothing by that. No harm. The picture was a scheme that I made up with a toy that I bought with $5. Today I'm announcing that this news was made up and that the picture was of a toy that I worked on with the help of some children. So I guess he and Dan Rather will be dining out shortly on the Dateline Montpelier, Vermont. To the relief of advocates for the mentally ill, the Vermont Teddy Bear Company said this week its straight-jacketed Crazy For You bears are sold out and will not make any more. Mental health advocates claimed victory. The company said it had decided weeks ago it would stop manufacturing the bears but would continue selling them through Valentine's Day. Aw. Last week, company president and CEO Elizabeth Robert had apologized to anyone offended by the bear, but said the bear would not be taken off the market. Quote, we're not in a position to be told what we can and cannot sell, unquote. Or they are. University of Colorado Regents on Thursday apologized to all Americans for remarks an ethnic studies professor made comparing victims of the 9/11 attacks to a Nazi leader. CU Regents also voted to review the writings and speeches of Ward Churchill, who in an essay called the victims of 9/11, quote, little Eichmanns, unquote. The meeting was marked by shouting, scuffling, and two arrests. The Dateline Boston, the Telegram and Gazette of Worcester, Massachusetts, called home its New England Patriots beat writer from the Super Bowl in Jacksonville after he allegedly plagiarized parts of his Sunday column from Sports Illustrated. The newspaper published a correction on Wednesday. We apologize to our readers, the paper said, and to Sports Illustrated. And Dateline Frankfurt, the creators of the hoax advertisement for Volkswagen's car that is circulated on the Internet, have apologized and promised not to repeat it, according to Volkswagen. The so-called viral ad, unauthorized by Volkswagen or its advertising agency, shows a suicide bomber detonating the explosives in a Volkswagen Polo parked outside a busy cafe, only to have the car absorb the blast. The advert ends with the Volkswagen logo and the actual slogan for the car, small but tough. Volkswagen said in a statement it had received sworn statements from the two creators, Dan Brooks and Lee Ford, acknowledging they had made the ad, but they had not intended for it to be distributed. Quote, the creators regret the distribution of the film, will not publicize it further, and apologize unreservedly for the damage caused to Volkswagen, it said, adding the company would now drop legal action against the pair. The pair made the fake advertisement in the hopes of getting a job. This is Le Show. And we have a few more apologies, ladies and gentlemen. The Dateline, Iowa's Public Safety Commissioner Kevin Techow apologized to legislators for what he called a misunderstanding. He's under fire for telling a newspaper reporter he'd review the state patrol's policies that keep large sections of police reports secret if the newspaper donated money to his agency. I regret the misunderstanding and my failure to communicate properly, he said, and I apologize for causing this to be construed in a way that means people think I was asking to be paid off. Dateline New York, Marshall McLennan Companies, the nation's largest insurance broker, agreed this week to pay $850 million to resolve allegations of fraud and anti-competitive practices. The agreement comes after New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer filed a lawsuit. Where's the apology? Oh, under the terms of the agreement, Marsh admitted to no wrongdoing. However, the company apologized for its unlawful and shameful conduct. So you can't have it both ways. Paul Runyon and James Jordan have never met in life and died 15 days apart at Central Suffolk Hospital in Riverhead, New York. Runyon after a short battle with cancer, Jordan after an amputation because of diabetes. Because of a morbid mix-up in the hospital morgue, Jordan's leg ended up at the home of Runyon's survivors. We do regret this happened, said hospital spokeswoman Nancy Uzzo. It appears to be human error. Representative Ernest Istook, Republican of Oklahoma, sent a written apology to GOP lawmakers whose transportation project he whacked out of the omnibus appropriations bill. He did it retaliating for their endorsement of additional funding for Amtrak. Same guy whose staff member... Oh, I can't even remember that story. That was from last October. Who remembers? Connecticut emergency management officials have apologized for an erroneous message sent to state broadcasters saying that an evacuation of the state had been ordered. State emergency management officials believe someone pressed the wrong button. And a former Portsmouth, New Hampshire police officer was found guilty of assault this week in what authorities call a case of cell phone rage. Karen Johnson, former policewoman, was charged with assaulting a man in a restaurant in November 2004. Hey, who wasn't acting crazy right about then? Quote, I wanted to apologize for acting like an idiot in the restaurant, Johnson said, offering a tearful apology on the witness stand. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Thank you.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is More Than You Know. More Than You Know, the weekly public radio series that focuses on events and personalities outside your ken. I'm Jacob Kitzel. Radio is about sound. Today, mainly the sound of music and the sound of voices. Here in public radio, there are many voices you think you know, and one that you probably don't realize that you do. CPR's special correspondent Aviva Schlorman introduces you to Henry Pensacola.
We're in a small recording studio deep inside the bowels of public radio. Outside, in the hallways and offices, there's hustle and bustle. News is being covered, opinions are being shared, decisions are being postponed. But here inside Studio 4J, one man stands in the beam of light thrown by a track lighting canister. He squints just a bit at the words on the paper that sits on the music stand. And then, as he does every day, he begins to weave his spell.
Support for this program comes from WayneKilgoreWillis.com. Information solutions that take the obvious a step beyond. Online at www.wkw.com.org. Jastro, a world of fingertips at your fingertips. www.jastro.com. The Republic of Liechtenstein, for coverage of Teutonic culture. Liechtenstein, we're in Europe too. And from the Public Broadcasting Foundation, making tax exemptions work twice as hard. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
That's great, Henry. That's a take.
Is it okay?
Yes, Henry. That's a take. That's a keeper.
Good. Onward.
Henry Pensacola has been in public radio for almost a decade. This Sephardic Jew with the shock of black hair and the shy smile spends his days inside Studio 4J, reading the funding credits at the beginning and end and increasingly in the middle of all our programs. Henry Pensacola is the most recognizable voice on our air. And yet you've never met him. Till now.
For the first couple of years here, I did a little bit of everything. I covered the environment beat. I hosted the Buffalo Philharmonic concerts. I was Scrooge when the news staff did their production of A Christmas Carol. But ultimately, as we all do, I began to specialize.
Henry, what was it about funding credits that drew you to specialize in them?
Well, they didn't seem to be read with any consistency, I guess. Anybody who had a spare moment would be brought in here to go through a bunch of them. Some people treated it as a sort of a chore. I convinced management that in the same way that every program's identity is wrapped up in a voice or two, our funding credits needed that same kind of identity. And I don't suppose it hurt that I tend to pronounce things pretty carefully.
Oh, the funders like that.
I suppose they do.
Henry, you make all the funding credits sound so easy, but I'm sure there have been some difficult challenges. Does any one stand out as particularly troublesome?
Well, there was one that was very difficult to keep a straight face during.
What was that?
The corporation had a grant from the American Bison Council. I think their slogan was, "Introducing a new generation to the other red meat."
And
something about it just broke me up. It took me about 24 takes to get it right.
Well, there's a famous tape of you that circulates inside the building here, isn't there?
Oh, you've heard it. Yes, we had a grant from the Marjorie Shuggin Foundation.
It gives money for the coverage of America's intellectual life, mm-hmm. and their catchphrase was "Shuggin, fit for brains." I don't know where my brain was that day, but some letters got switched around, and
the highlight of every public radio Christmas party was born.
I guess it was.
Every day, the funding department sends Henry a printout of the day's financial supporters. Every day, he wrestles with nuances of tone and pronunciation.
A lot of them are our regulars, mm-hmm. you know, your agribusiness giants, your foreign countries, mm-hmm. and rich families have been with us all along, mm-hmm. but every day there's some new internet investment service with the unpronounceable names of four partners or a medical foundation supporting coverage of a disease that you've never heard of because, to be fair, there hasn't been coverage. But let me put it this way. Every day there's some reason why we don't get to lunch before 1:30.
But there are times, aren't there, where you get to exercise a little more creativity?
Well, as with almost everything else, there are slow seasons for public radio fundraising. I don't pretend to know the reasons, budgetary constraints, mm-hmm. End of fiscal years, that sort of thing.
Of course.
Anyway, when those times roll around, we used to just slow down the reading. Say, we just had one funder,
mm-hmm.
in a slot where we normally would have three, and if there was nobody to credit, we just had this little piece of music we played. Well, that became known around the stations as the Poorhouse Suite.
Oh.
And I got memos that my slow reading was driving people a little nuts.
How slow was it?
Oh, let's see. Support for this program comes from the TV Guide Foundation, helping to build awareness of jazz. About like that.
No, that must be hard to do.
Well, it's very hard to keep your concentration. Your mind tends to wander off during the pauses, so I began making up funders, you know, foundations and corporations that sound just like the real ones.
Mm-hmm.
So now, instead of us advertising that it's a slow time, we sound as if we're sold out year-round.
Henry, do you get fan mail?
I've gotten marriage proposals, one from a woman who wrote that hearing my voice always made her think of good things like disease prevention, the environment, and the arts. And she liked that.
Okay, Henry, just do the ending one more time for us.
Okay. Rolling?
Just a minute.
Mm.
Okay, yes, we're rolling now.
This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Yes, that's a good one, Henry. See you tomorrow.
All right. Bye-bye.
When Henry Pensacola leaves Studio 4J, he and his engineer are the only persons who know what credits have been recorded in what sequence for airing on what program. It's a security precaution based on necessity.
A few years ago, management here learned that people at the stations around the country, you know, the announcers and the engineers waiting to do the local break,
mm-hmm.
They were running gambling pools on what the credits would be.
Gambling pools?
Yes, you know, at the end of this half hour, it'll be such and such a foundation,
mm-hmm.
or such and such a movie for smart people. Mm-hmm. These folks were betting large sums of money, well, large for public radio, and there was some concern that people who got inside information in advance as to what credits were going to actually run could take advantage of the situation.
Oh my goodness.
So
like everything else in this modern world, we now have airtight security. Just for having heard that session of Eva, we now have to kill you and your crew.
Henry Pensacola, giving credits where credits are due. Sworn to secrecy in Washington, I'm Aviva Schlorman.
And for this week, that's More Than You Know.
This is Le Show. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for news from the digital wonderland. I tend to share this with you on occasion, and this is a good day to do it. Sean Henson, this is from the Baltimore Sun, an avid Baltimore Ravens fan, bought herself a 65-inch Toshiba high-definition television as a Christmas present, planning to have a big Super Bowl party with her new purchase as the main attraction. But she discovered she doesn't truly have high definition. No! The new technology that promises a picture at least five times as clear as that on regular television. By the way, the hyperbole about this just gets better and better. The BBC reported that high definition is 3D-like. Yes, it is, except that it's 2D. Where's that missing dimension? Inquiring mind. Without high definition, the images on her screen, her big 65-inch screen, look stretched and out of focus to her, like in many hotels now. Now, she and her friends are thinking of carpooling to a bar to watch the Super Bowl. I spent almost $3,000 and the picture is horrible, said Henson, a photographer from Cockeysville. Gets better. This is the biggest game of the year, she says. She and tens of thousands of other owners of high-definition televisions are caught in a continuing feud between some broadcasters and cable companies. The local broadcasters want to charge the cable companies to retransmit their digital television signals. The cable companies are resisting. Fox is trying to be greedy? Are you? Sinclair Broadcast Group, which owns the Baltimore Fox affiliate, it wants Comcast, the local cable operator, to pay to retransmit. Oh, it's not Fox. It's Sinclair. That's okay. So, good news for everybody who's trying to watch the Super Bowl in cities where Sinclair owns a Fox affiliate. Or others. And speaking of the digital wonderland, NPR may try to jumpstart sales of digital radio receivers this year by buying upwards of 50,000 radios to be resold to listeners. These are your pledge dollars in action, ladies and gentlemen. The network has pitched the possibility of a group buy to all manufacturers of digital receivers. NPR announced this in Las Vegas. Where else? The network said it will begin distributing four 24-hour programming streams. Jazz, classical, news, talk, and a fourth yet to be considered because what would they do? What would it be? You want to help? NPR is going to sell you your digital radio so that they can sell you more digital radio. And speaking of which, quote, sometime between now and the end of the week, you may notice a delay when listening to us directly off the air. This is a result of our new HD radio digital transmissions. This is a memo to me from the home station. HD is a separate all-digital signal we transmit, which is receivable by HD-equipped radios. The digital encoding technology delays the audio by approximately 8 seconds. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. One of the great side effects of the digital radio transition, as well as the digital television transmission, is there is no more live broadcasting. You're welcome. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, you noticed that the Oil for Food program at the United Nations, the report on it by Paul Volcker, former head of the Fed, fingers this one guy for using his influence to divert, using his influence to get oil contracts to a pal of his. The stories that I've read, I haven't read a lot because I've been basically celebrating the Iraqi election here with my beaded friends, mentions the total amount of the Oil for Food program, which was some 60-some-odd billion dollars, give or take a billion. It doesn't mention really the amount that's at question. Hundreds of thousands is all I've seen in the context of these particular contracts and the conflict of interest involved. But the conservatives have been fulminating about this being perhaps the biggest scandal in the history of the world. Meanwhile, as they say in the news, the American Occupation Authority that governed Iraq until mid-2004 did not properly monitor the spending of $8.8 billion in Iraqi money, opening the door to possible corruption, according to the federal watchdog agency. So we don't know that possible corruption, ladies and gentlemen. That's always the most tempting kind. The Bush administration's claim this week that North Korea appears to have been the supplier of converted uranium to Libya is based on evidence that could just as easily point to hands. Thank you, Pakistan. That's right. Our friend, our good friend Pak, as the source of the converted uranium. Two senior staff members on the National Security Council have turned China, Japan, and South Korea in recent days to brief top officials that U.S. scientific tests strongly suggest North Korea provided Libya with uranium gas. China and South Korea in particular have been skeptical that North Korea has a clandestine uranium enrichment program. The administration's case is gets very complex here, but the International Atomic Energy Agency, which conducted tests on the same materials from Libya, has not reached the same finding and believes that the evidence is inconclusive, reason enough to, as many administration officials want to, get rid of the head of the IAEA. Or as George W. Bush called it, the IEAE. Several experts said the process of elimination cited by the administration in its leak to the New York Times still left open the possibility of other sources for the uranium. For the uranium, I said. The IAEA has been investigating the nuclear smuggling network headed by Pakistan's father of its nuclear bomb, A.Q. Khan. Has collected a mountain of evidence pointing to both Pakistan and North Korea as Libya's source of uranium. Why don't we just ask Gaddafi? He's nice now, isn't he? Sure he is. Now, ladies and gentlemen, another venture into the world of public radio.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is All in All. All in All. Now, once weekly, once over deeply, on a not-so-top news story of the day. I'm Ira Zipkin. Every day, cigarette smoking becomes a more difficult habit to maintain. Cities and states pass more and more restrictions on where the habit can be indulged in. And many smokers, unable to quit, are feeling the pressure. That's where the community of Oak Falls, California, entered the picture. With a new law that's all smoke and no mirrors. Aviva Schlarman sent this report back from Oak Falls.
Like a lot of communities here in California, this town was rather whimsically named. There's no falls here and virtually no oaks.
Mayor Art Carneros knew his town had a problem.
It's flat here, no real tourist attraction, and the recession hit us pretty hard. But that right over there, that's where the borax plant used to be. Now those few customers who are still in the market, they get their borax from the Japanese at half the price. Beats me how they do it. So anyway, we had to do something to get folks in here if we were going to stay afloat.
Mayor Carneros came up to me before a council meeting one night. Said he had a little idea.
City Council President Jay Teagle, who also owns the local newspaper, the Weekly Teagle.
Simple idea, he says. Make Oak Falls the first smoker's city. Legalize smoking everywhere in public. Encourage smokers to come here and raise a family as long as they're able. And everybody else was, you know, scaring them away. And the art mayor said, let's be the place they want to come to. I thought about it a minute, you know. Sounded kind of strange on first hearing and all. Then I said, well, hell, Borax people aren't coming back. We got to do something. I got behind it faster than a heifer in heat.
Becoming a smoker's haven didn't just involve convincing the city's power elite. By its nature, it was a project that required all of Oak Falls to get behind it. Even non-smokers like Alma Lassito. For 21 years, Alma has poured coffee and served donuts at the Nibble Nook coffee shop.
Well, you know, it's a small community. And if you were thought to be a person standing in the way of civic improvement or something, people would let you know about their feelings very quickly. I'm not saying that happened in this situation, but, you know, I hate the smell of cigarettes personally, but from what I've seen, especially during this downturn, being out of a job smells worse, so we're just putting in a few more air fresheners in the place, the pine scent, you know, and we hope for the best.
We've been a little disappointed by the response so far. I guess with all the other things going on, the war and such, we haven't gotten as much media play as we thought. But we're taking the next step, and we're changing the town's name to make it fit in more with the kind of place that we are.
What's the new name to be, Mayor?
Well, we're having to hold a little referendum on that question this coming week. Some of us thought, let's just be obvious and call it the town of Marlboro, but other folks, I guess more in keeping with their own tastes or something, want it to be called the town of Merritt Light. So we'll vote on it one way or another. When people come through on the state highway or see us on the maps, they'll know we're the smoker's town. And we think if they're smokers, they'll want to come here.
Down the road, if we even start thinking this might work, we're going to expand on it. There's some very serious talk about building a Smokers Hall of Fame here in town to pay tribute to some of the, you know, the most accomplished people from all walks of life who've smoked.
You'd think that the tobacco industry would be behind the folks in Oak Falls like, well, yes, like a heifer in heat. But Bill Turnage of the Tobacco Information Bureau in New York almost sounds as if he's, well, waiting for the smoke to settle.
We're very happy any time a community makes America's smokers feel welcome to exercise their rights to smoke. Don't get us wrong. But we don't necessarily want to endorse what this particular community is doing, basically because we think that every town should be a smoker's town, if you will.
I'd just say to any smokers who are feeling persecuted or picked on, we know how you feel, and you're as welcome as can be in Marlboro or Merritt Light.
Mayor Art Carneros, trying to keep the flame of small-town pride lit. I'm Aviva Schlarman.
And for this week, that's all for All in All. Funds for this program come from the CPR End of the Fiscal Year Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Ruminative Journalism and the Tobacco Foundation. I'm Ira Zipkin. Join us next week when we skim beneath the surface on another story of current near interest on All in All. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
And this is Le Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. It's been a while, isn't it? Seems like it. Maybe it's just the beads and the celebrating of the freedom and everything. In any case, from Media Week, radio's long ad pods turn off listeners. I'll read it for you. People need to be told this. A new study indicates that radio listeners are likely to stay tuned to the radio when there are shorter commercial pods. Pods is radio talk for clusters, commercials. Lending new credence to Clear Channel's Less is More initiative, which was instituted across all the company stations last month. The study by Navigage, a research service that passively tracks in-car listening in Atlanta, hey, that's a good business, found that 88% of listeners will stay tuned through a single commercial or island spot. As might be expected, the longer the commercial pod, the more likely listeners are to change the station. In a commercial break of four or fewer spots, 80% of the audience stays tuned through the second commercial, 70% stay tuned through the third. Just under half the audience is retained when six or more commercials run. Those poor people need medical help. The study also found that 30-second spots retain more audience than a 60-second spot. Somebody paid for this study. Wait, there's more. For 60-second spots, the audience drop-off is 15% versus 6% for a 30. This finding reinforces Clear Channel's desire to move more advertisers toward a 30-second unit as the traditional length of a radio spot. For the study, Navigage examined 46,000 ad pods and more than 127,000 commercials over a three-month period last fall. Mommy, that's what I want to do when I grow up. Examine 127,000 commercials. But those are the kind of career choices that present themselves, ladies and gentlemen, when I read the trades for you. Yes, thanks for asking. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. By the way, here's the reason that there's an 8-second delay on my home station now. The technology which transmits the HD signals takes roughly 8 seconds to encode programming. The radios which decode this signal are designed to automatically switch between the digital and analog signals when it can't clearly receive digital. Thus, for the switch to be transparent, we have to delay the analog, i.e. normal, signal. Total number of people who have digital radios at the moment. How many fingers you got?
Little Liza Jane.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz. Around the world via your computer on the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free download at audible.com/LeShow. Let's all go to audible.com park, shall we? And on channel 108 on Sirius Satellite Radio. And it would be just like me not talking over vocals if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. Uh-huh.
See, I got a girl from the Zulu land. Lies again. Said it loud, loud, baby, don't know her name.
The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks for not operating behind the beat bubble this week. The show playlists usually available at harryshearer.com. And a tip of the giant, oversized, grotesquely amusing Le Show chapeau to Mr. Bob Dunn at WWL-TV New Orleans for helping us celebrate the Iraqi election these past 5 weeks. We're going to miss you, bud. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world, think of it, as the home of the homeless.